But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
Good morning and welcome to Playing with Fire, Long Island's only food, wine, and lifestyle show. I'm your host, Tom Shardell, and I'm here with, with co-host and producer Stu Schrager. Good morning, Stu.
Good morning, Tom. Happy Easter.
Happy Easter to you. You know, if it doesn't apply, but...
Well, you're a working soul, so...
Yeah. No, it's a beautiful Easter Sunday morning, and hopefully everybody's going to enjoy the day, have some fun. You know, I got a chance to... Last Wednesday night, I got my annual chance to do a Seder, you know, speaking of the holidays. And it's fun for me, but it's a lot of work. It's kind of like Thanksgiving with like a kind of a religious side to it, because there's a lot of stuff that I normally don't use, you know. I have to bring in product or whatever. But the fun part for me is I get to cook stuff that I never get to cook the rest of the year. Like I don't have a big call for matzo ball soup or... chopped liver, things like that. So I get a chance to do all those things, which is kind of fun. You know, I make, I get to do the Seder plate, which is kind of fun. I get to do beet horseradish, which I never really do during the year. So for me, it's a hoot, you know. We had a good time. We had about 80 people show up for the Seder, and good time was had by all.
Yeah. Now, are your recipes very traditional? Like... your matzo balls, some people like small, hard ones. Some people like big, fluffy ones. They sink or swim.
Yeah, I'm a floater. I like light matzo balls. I don't make them too big. I mean, I've had them the size of your head, you know. It just kind of displaces too much soup for me, you know. So I'm probably a... You know, when I make them, when I roll them, they're a little less than golf ball size.
Oh.
So they blow up to the size of maybe a, I don't know what the diameter would be, maybe 2 inches in diameter or something like that. So if you had a cup of soup, you could theoretically put one in a cup and still have some soup left, you know. Or if you had a bowl, you could put two in and, you know, you'd be a bowl. So, but I like a nice tender matzo ball. I don't think they should be, you know, like completely, you know, soft, but they need a little texture, I think. But too much texture means to me that they probably haven't been cooked long enough. And, you know, I cook mine in chicken stock, and so it imparts a lot of flavor into them. But I love them. I mean, I eat them cold, you know. And then soup's fun to me because, we start with the bones. You know, I don't cheat. You know, we start with chicken bones and make a nice broth. And, you know, I use dill in there and some vegetables. And, you know, obviously I cook the chicken in the broth, and then, which double strengths the broth, you know. And so, yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's... chopped liver, to me, it's one of the few things I can't get down. I gag at the taste of a chicken liver. But, I'll make it, and then I'll have somebody else taste it to see if there's enough salt in it. Because I don't really like it myself. But it was fun. And Kavelta fish, you know, I got to tell you a funny story about Kavelta fish. Last year we did a Seder, but it was kind of like part of the dinner. It was just like a Seder special. You know, we only had 7, 8, 10 people show up for whatever it was. And nobody ate the Kavelta fish. Now, I don't make it, obviously. I just buy it, you know. But so I said to the manager, you know, it was a friend of mine, Don, I said, listen, I don't think anybody under the age of 80 eats Kavelta fish anymore, you know. So I said, if we don't sell any this year, can we stop the charade and, you know, we'll make another nice, you know, appetizer special. Don't you know I ran out of Kavelta fish?
Wow.
Yeah, it was like, I said, okay, I surrender. I guess people under 80 do eat it, you know. I can't imagine why. I look at it, I'm like, really? God, no. But anyway, it was fun. We had brisket. You know, I made a nice little braised brisket, and we had fun salmon chicken thing. And then, dessert was berries and or flourless chocolate cake. And we had an apple tart, whatever. It was a lot of fun, you know, just a good time. And like I said, we had about 80 people, and, I got a lot of high fives and, you know, thank yous and stuff. It was great.
That's all good. It was
a lot of fun. A lot of fun.
So I have to go back in the calendar a little bit because I'll share my past 10 days, which have been very, very self-satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
But at the Passover Seder, which I guess my mom prepared a unbelievable Jewish soul food array.
Feast,
it was
yeah.
just incredible. But one of the conversations that went on during the Seder was, I guess, a couple of weeks before was St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah, yeah.
And the traditional way, I believe, of cooking corned beef is to boil it.
Yeah.
And apparently, one of my cousins baked a corned beef.
Oh, boy.
Or broiled the corned beef.
Well,
I guess
even
broiled
worse.
is the right term.
Yeah.
And supposedly it tasted nice, but I mean, you broil a brisket, right?
You braise it.
You braise a brisket.
Mm-hmm.
That means in a casserole?
Braise means both hot and, both wet and dry heat. So braising, what you would do is you would sear it in a dry pan in oil, you know what I mean? And then you would add the liquid and either, you know, finish it on the top of the oven by simmering it slowly or putting it in the oven with a cover on it, you know? So the liquid basically breaks down the tissue. Baking or, you know, roasting a corned beef to me would be suspect. I'd be a little worried about that.
I was surprised. They said it came out delicious, but
some people eat anything, yeah.
So then moving forward to share some of my personal life, I was honored to be able to be at my grandson's bar mitzvah.
Nice.
Last weekend, which was really cool.
Mazel tov.
Brought back memories of my youth. My family was very involved in the local temple, and we would go every Friday night, and I would participate in leading the service. And lo and behold, my grandson was up there doing that. The only difference in my day, we would wear like shoes, and today the kids wear sneakers.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so there's no formality anymore.
He got, you know, two special pair for the his bar mitzvah.
Air Jordans.
But yeah. So that was interesting. And I guess I'm confused because the attendance at the Friday night service was very small, to say the least.
Mm.
Yet the few times I go with Kerry to her church or whatever, it seems to be a lot more participation, a lot more attendance.
Mm.
So I was a little confused about that. I don't know if I don't know what that means for religion and organized prayer service going forward 20 years from now.
Yeah, it seems to be on the wane, you know.
Yeah, so that was interesting. And then Saturday, he did his official ceremony and the prayer service, and it was incredible to be a part of it. It was sad at one point in reflection of those not there.
Sure,
and
yeah.
I'll tell you a crazy story associated with that. But when my oldest daughter got married, I guess about 14 years ago, I guess it was the engagement party, I made a speech and I said how blessed we were that there were great grandparents there and grandparents.
Sure,
and parents
yeah.
that, you know, it's just not the norm.
Yeah.
And now my mom's sort of the matriarch and there's not too many elders around.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're one of them, by the way.
That's right. I'm the patriarch in training. I sort of put my foot in my mouth, and I guess it's my daughter and my son-in-law don't share a lot of the craziness of their lives. My son-in-law's mother has got some issues, and I know his uncle had a health issue, so I saw the aunt there, and I said, you know, sorry we didn't get to see your husband. I hope he's doing well. And mm-hmm. she goes, nah, he passed.
Oh, boy.
So that was one of the most awkward moments for me.
Yeah. So how about those Yankees?
Just about.
Yeah.
Just about. That was really that was a rough one. But I was able, I don't know how, but I sort of got my foot out of my mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And then enjoyed the rest of the afternoon. But that really was
Yeah, those moments are a trip, you know. I gotta tell you a kind of a funny story related to that. And for me, suppressed laughter is kind of the worst thing that can happen to you because everything is three times as funny as it would normally be if you're not allowed to laugh. So when I'm put in situations, for some reason, I do some of my best work in religious situations like church, temple, or wakes. And so I got to tell you, I had my friend Eddie asked me to do a reading at his son's bar mitzvah. So, of course, I was honored to do it. And I said, yeah, of course, Eddie, I'll do that, you know. And somehow we were out the night before a little later than we should have been for an early ceremony, you know. And I was a little fuzzy in the morning, you know. And, you know, you're tired, you get the giggles, and, you know, everything seems to be funny. And as soon as I go into a religious building, you know, I don't know, something comes over me. And I always say the wrong thing. I always just foot in the mouth situation, right? So I'm supposed to be doing this reading, and it's my time is coming, and I know when I'm supposed to get up there. And the cantor has a voice like Tiny Tim. Now, he goes into this thing in Hebrew, you know, at soprano, like Barry Gibbs on the Bee Gees. And now okay, Tom, you're up. Are you kidding me? I'm hanging on by my fingernails, trying not to laugh, you know. And I'm looking at Eddie in the front row, and I see his shoulders are going, you know. It's like even worse. I must have stopped about three times trying to keep biting my lip, my tongue, the whole thing. But the reason I brought that up is because I'm talking about putting your foot in your mouth and being in these situations. I got to tell you, this week the world lost a real superstar. My friend Sandy passed away, my friend in Florida, you know.
Condolences.
And, thank you.
The past couple of weeks we've talked about Sandy.
Yeah.
I felt you were a little remiss, which I still want to correct you. You might not have been as timely as you would have liked to have been.
Yeah.
But you made the effort, and that should not be forgotten by yourself.
Thank you. So my friend Sandy, to give anybody who hasn't heard of him or listened to the show a background, I met Sandy in, I think it was 1971 or two, when I was 18 years old. And he was working in a place that I was working in. He was older than me. Sandy was probably about then his late 30s, early 40s at the time. And he became my dear friend, B, father figure. My dad and I had a contentious relationship for the sake of reference, and mentor, and business partner. And so a long story short, Sandy and I spent 6 days a week together for about 40 years. And when he was off, I missed him. I mean, that's how much fun I had with Sandy. We were just quite the pair. And he was just maybe the kindest human being I ever met in my life. I've never heard him say a bad word about anybody except Jacques Pepin, for some reason. When you mentioned Jacques Pepin, he went right to Lou Costello in Niagara Falls, you know. And it's funny because you could say anything about it, like pick your least favorite serial killer, you know. John Gacy, Sandy will, yeah, you know, but he probably had a tough childhood, you know. He always had something nice to say about it. Stalin, you know, he had good leadership qualities. You know, he couldn't bring himself to say anything bad about anybody. Jacques Pepin, piece of human garbage. Thomas, he would go off like a firecracker, right? And I said, well, what did he do? Because they worked together, you know. I said, what did he do? Saying, nah, it doesn't matter. He wouldn't disparage him, but he just wanted me to know that anyway, it was hilarious, you know. So I've been trying to live up to Sandy's ideals forever, and it's hard, man. He had what I like to call soul shine. You know, he had that kind of personality that everybody was drawn to, you know. So anyway, here's the classic Sandy story. So Sandy and I, we work in this place, and there were three of us working on the line. It was his partner, the other owner, Sandy, myself. And his partner was a terrible line cook. Great guy, but terrible line cook, right? So Sandy and I could do 300 dinners by ourselves. If his partner got involved, we could do 26 without, you know, I mean, it was just a meltdown. He was terrible. So it became apparent we had to hire another guy. So we hired this guy. I'll call him John. So John comes, and John's greatest attribute was an ability to tell a story that never happened. You know, it was like he would go on these tears. He was telling me stories about when he was in the Army, and then 2 weeks later when he was in the Navy, and a week after that he was in the Marines, you know. And we didn't know much about John other than the fact that he was the world's busiest guy during the war. You know, he had all kinds of things going on. He was in every branch of the Army. And Sandy says to me one day, Thomas, you think he was in the Foreign Legion, the French Foreign Legion? He was just, so we kind of laughed about it. Lo and behold, John passes away suddenly from a heart attack, and he was in his, like, probably middle 40s, you know. So, like, and we only knew him for like a month, you know. So I'm like, wow, that's like only. So I said, should we go to the wake, you know? So Sandy goes, yeah, I guess we should go, you know. Well, the only day we could go was the first day, which is usually kind of, you know, first showing family or whatever, you know. So we get there, we're in the parking lot of the funeral home, and his mother was still alive, and you can imagine being a parent, you know, the worst thing you can do is outlive your kids, right? And so they lead the mother in the family, and the mother freaks out, and she's trying to hug the corpse, and it's just this big drama scene. So I said, let's just hang back in the parking lot and give them 20 minutes or whatever. So we finally go in there, and, you know, Sandy goes up to the coffin, and he kneels down on a little bench there, and he kind of loses it. I see him, buries his head in his hands, you know, whatever. So he comes back to me, and he's got his hands over his face, and I'm saying, Sandy, are you okay? He goes, wait till you see his hair. Wait till you see his hair? Are you kidding me? Who does this to somebody? And he goes back in. Anyway, so I go up to the coffin, and the mother, when she was upset and trying to hug the corpse, knocked his hair out of place, and he had an alfalfa sticking in the back of his, straight up in the back of his head, right? So now I'm down, right? So I come back. I got my head in my hands, and the two of us are hysterical in the back of the funeral home, laughing, you know, when everybody else is grieving. And I'm like looking for the, you know, the men's room, so we got to get out of here, right? So the mother comes over to us, and we're still facing the hands, you know. You must have loved our son, my son, John. We did, you know. Down into the, we were in the bathroom for 45 minutes trying to get it back together. And every time I would say, listen, you idiot, don't, we got to get out of here. We got to just go to the parking lot, get to the car, and get out of here. And we would start all over again. And it was just, it wasn't we were laughing at the, you know, in the face of death or anything. It was just all of that release, you know, from the anxiety or whatever. But, man, when you're not allowed to laugh, everything is five times as funny. But anyway, Sandy was the best companion, friend, mentor, father figure. You know what he said to me one time? Was one of the greatest lessons. He taught me an awful lot. He taught me a lot about cooking. He taught me a lot about life. But John was, the same guy, was telling this particularly crazy story about flying an airplane in on the enemy fire with Arabian horses in the back. And, you know, this whole crazy thing, right? So Sandy goes, so Thomas, what'd you think of that story? I said, you know, he's full of you-know-what. He goes, yeah, he is. I said, well, it wasn't true. So Sandy goes to me, Thomas, when you go to the movies, do you ever wonder if the story's true or not? I said, no, why? He goes, the only important thing is it's a good story, right? I said, yeah, I guess so. He goes, well, congratulations. What does a movie cost you, $7, $8? You just saved $7 or $8. It was a good story. And he was basically trying to tell me, don't judge unless you be judged. He was just that kind of guy, you know? And I never forgot that. I said, you know what? He's right. It's like, who cares? You know, it's just, I'll miss him terribly. Like I said, I you know, I spent 40 years, 6 days a week with him, and I wish we would have had more time.
I gotcha. Well, that last story that you told is an interesting way to look at life. Instead of critiquing, just take it as a story and move
on. Yeah, yeah.
That's priceless. That's a priceless
It was. It was a lesson. He had hundreds of them, and he was a funny guy. You know, his wife was kind of a henpecker, you know. So he used to turn his hearing aid off, right? It was like hilarious. And he would forget to turn it on when he came to work. So I'd be going like, Sandy, I need two seafood salads for 27. Two Caesar salads coming up. Oh, seafood, Stanton, seafood, you know? fire table 26. 26, Thomas Fox. I watch it all the time. No, Sandy, he was hilarious. I mean, he would quote speeches from the Roman Senate floor and, you know, 60 AD or whatever. He was just a character and a half. And, oh, my God, just maybe the finest human being I ever knew. He was just great. Anyway.
Oh, that was a great
morning tribute. All right, peace, Ant and Jay. Yeah, too much. Anyway, back to food.
So, wait, before we get back into food, so talking about putting your foot in your mouth.
Yeah.
So I once went to an event over at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn, and I was invited to a reception before the event.
Right.
So I walk in and there's two, let's say, chubby young ladies.
Oh boy.
One being pregnant, one being chubby.
Oh boy.
On the way out, and Carrie said she tried to save me. I went to the chubby one. What do you do?
Oh boy.
She said I tried.
Yeah, I did that on a buffet line one time. There was a woman that came up, and she says, you know, I'll have a little more of that prime rib. I said, well, you're eating for two. And she goes, what are you talking about? And I'm like, yeah, baby, you and your husband?
Yeah,
you
know, I learned my lesson. I'm not married. I don't usually comment on that anymore.
No, you got to be very, very careful about that.
Like, I'll ask somebody first.
Yeah.
So anyway, continuing on last weekend was the bar mitzvah. And during the week, Wednesday and Thursday was Passover Seder.
Yeah.
And again, my mom put together this incredible meal. Mom now decides she can't do two meals. she can only do one, yet there's enough food for four meals.
Of course.
But we had anything from turkey and brisket. She had store-bought gefilte fish, but she makes her own chopped liver, her own soup with matzo balls. There was a spinach souffle and carrot something.
Yeah.
And she made chocolate caramel-covered matzo. I mean, just an incredible spread. You know, we're just so lucky that she can still do it. And then the second night she decided to go to Pastrami King. And part of it's interesting, and it goes with your story about the chopped liver. Two of my daughters are with guys that aren't Jewish, and I'm convinced they're scared of the gefilte fish and the...
With good reason.
The chopped liver. Yeah. So going to Pastrami King makes it a little more Americanized.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
And apparently, though, the highlight of the meal for most people was they went with pastrami sliders.
Well, yeah, there you go. Yeah.
So, it was great to get together, and again... kudos to my mom for facilitating everything, because we had half the family the first night, the rest of the family the next night. And it was great to be together, because as I also found out recently, my youngest daughter is pregnant.
Oh, wow.
So there's just a lot of good stuff going on.
Yeah,
I'm
cool.
I'm really thankful that, you know.
Grandpa still.
Yeah, so this will be my third, and the baby should be coming in September. So, and it's going to be a little boy.
Wow.
And hopefully it's not named after me, because in the Jewish religion, we name after deceased. So I hope not to have the baby.
Yeah, no, you don't want to. Yeah, no.
But any rate, we're sitting here on Easter Sunday. Life today is very complicated. I go to watch a baseball game, and there's all sorts of new rules. I had to take an hour with my son to sort of go through them for me. And then everybody's all protective of the weather. I guess the Mets were supposed to have opening day on Thursday, and they postponed it because it was going to rain. And lo and behold, I don't believe it really rained.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think they're trying to shorten the games or something. Is that what
they're supposed to? But there's so many. They made the bases bigger. They're speeding it up. I'm saying, where's the clock? Because here in the studio, we can't even find the clock to figure out how long the show is.
Well, I mean, they have a shot clock in basketball. There's a shot clock in golf, you know. I think making the things a little quicker is good. I mean, I remember when I was a baseball fan as a kid. I don't watch it anymore, but, you know, game was 3 hours. Now it's 4.5. I mean, you know, because every batter has to, after every pitch, got to step back, got to adjust each glove. They got to pull up their crotch. They got to pick their pants up in the back. They got to adjust their socks. Just hit it. Well, yeah, for God's sake, you know. I mean, what's the problem?
They say, though, baseball used to be the number one sport in America, and I think now it's like, number 10.
Well, it's like watching a bridge rust. You know what I mean? It's like, takes forever. And like, come on, you know, get with it. And, I think, too, what's happening is, you know, all these sports are trying to push all of this agenda down everybody's throats, you know. They're all involved in politics, not just any other thing. Sports is supposed to be an escape from all of that. It's supposed to be, you know, come on, let's just leave all of that crap behind and go enjoy a game. And now you can't even do that anymore.
Sandy would,
you know,
say, enjoy it. It's another good story.
It's a good story. You don't need all that other stuff, you know. It's just, I don't know, bizarre.
And then... another craziness going on, the young people today. There's a movie that came out on Friday or this past week, Mario Brothers, the movie, and it's a cartoon of a video game and all the characters therein.
Well, here's my take on that. With all the professed, or self-professed, I should say, talent that there is in Hollywood, really? I mean, you know, one guy gets a good idea, right, like a movie, and then they have 75 sequels. They wring it out like a towel until there's nothing left, right? And if there's so much talent in Hollywood, why are we doing remakes of Bewitched, you know, or Get Smart or whatever, you know? There really isn't that much talent out there, you know? When you think about how many movies come out and how many you're compelled to see, you know, and then you watch these shows, these inane award shows where, you know, we're so wonderful, we're so talented, we're so, yeah, our business is so great, this, that, and the other thing. You got people walking around with 30 ribbons on them. They look like Idi Amin. You know, they got a ribbon for this, a ribbon for climate change, a ribbon for LGBT, a ribbon for this. They look ridiculous to me, you know?
So I have a weird thought for you, and I'm interested in your commentary. You talked about the award show, and my mind goes to the red carpet. And as a younger person in college, I used to get Gentleman's Quarterly magazine.
Wow.
Which was a fashion magazine for men.
Who knew?
But there was actually styles and trends that were obtainable that I could afford to partake in.
Mm-hmm.
And now the magazine itself, or the women's versions, Vogue and whatever, and these different award shows, the outfits are so abstract and far-reaching.
No, they're costumes.
I guess they are.
Yeah,
and I don't believe the average person can attain to get there and be able to wear an outfit like that. I mean, you know.
Well, who would wear a meat dress? Wasn't it a couple of years ago somebody had a meat dress on?
Yes, that was Lady Gaga. But you're absolutely right. But I'll give you a quick example of what I'm trying to share. So in the day, if there was weddings, bar mitzvahs or whatever, when my kids were younger, and I saw something on TV with a velvet tuxedo jacket, maybe with, I forget the
lapels.
With the lapels that
satin.
Yeah. But at any rate, but it was a look that I liked. It was something that I could go to the store and get.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fun. It was enjoyable in my own craziness.
Yeah.
Again, you can't. First of all, the price of the things that these people, everything's, you know, high design, this,
of course,
that, and the
yeah,
other.
Yeah, yeah.
But I guess I'm getting old because I just don't understand where we're at.
Well, you know, everybody pushes boundaries, and it's funny about fashion because it cycles around. I remember when when my father was in the Navy, they had these bell-bottom pants, you know, and then all of a sudden bell-bottoms became cool when they first come out. I remember seeing them in like early 60s going, oh, I would never wear anything like that. And then by 68 to 69, you know, you wouldn't wear straight pants. Everybody was in bell-bottoms. And they'll come back again. You know, they always do. But, yeah, I mean, that Hollywood stuff is just so over the top. And so, I don't know, transparently cheap, you know, in its, you know, in its presentation.
When you talk about fashion, there was a funny thing recently. I guess the style today is very tailored for a young man, very tailored pants, maybe a little short.
Mm.
And somebody made the comment, who knew that the youth of today were looking to be like Pee Wee Herman?
Yeah, exactly. That's what they look like. Yeah.
You know, seriously, they're very tailored jackets.
Yeah.
And
short pants with white socks.
Very tapered at the bottom.
Yeah, and a fedora. I want to slap the fedora off every head I see, you know. But anyway, to bring that back to food, you know who does the catering at the Oscars, don't you?
Wolfgang Puck.
Yeah, Wolfgang, the world's richest chef. He was the original superstar. And you know what? Deservedly so. I mean, he did. He changed the way the world thought about restaurants, which is no small feat. That's kind of like I remember talking to a kid about the Beatles. And he was the Beatles. Oh, yeah, that was Paul McCartney's other band, right? Yeah, that was his other band. But I remember getting into a discussion with him. He says, well, what did they really do? I said, well, you know, other than change the way the world thought about music, fashion, and politics and religion, nothing. You know, it was like he missed the whole thing because he was so young, you know. But Wolfgang was the same way. You know, Wolfgang's the first guy that made pizza cool. Wolfgang was the first guy that made open kitchens. Wolfgang was the first guy that took chefs out of the back and brought them into the front. You know, where it was always the manager would get all the credit and, the maitre d' was the guy. Let's go see Robert at the, you know, Le Pavillon. Let's go see Henri over here. And, you know, all of a sudden the chef became, you know, the kind of the star of the show. And it was all Wolfgang. And, you know, all of us have a debt to pay him for that. You know, sometimes I could kill him for it. But he was the one. He was the guy. Spago was the restaurant. And Spago almost didn't happen. It was just the... You know, he just kind of branched out. There was a guy he was working for named Patrick Terrell who owned a place called Mama San. And he was a brilliant guy. You know, that was the guy that unlisted the phone number to the restaurant. And he did it specifically as a psychological ploy because he knew that every woman in L.A. would scratch each other's eyes out to get the thing if they couldn't have it. And he was right. It was the whole Studio 54 thing. You know, you can't come in, you can't come in, you can't come in. And the next night, the three of them are there, you know, with a different outfit trying to get in. So I guess we always want what we can't have. And I always thought, geez, that'd be a great thing to do on Long Island. I'll unlist the phone number. And then I realized that nobody would care. And then I'd be, you know, killing myself. But anyway, the bottom line was he was the manager there. I mean, the chef there. And he said to the manager owner, you know, I'd like a piece of this. You know, we're kind of rescuing this restaurant. It's going in the right direction. I'd like to be a partner. And the guy said, no. So Wolfgang went out on his own and begged, borrowed, stole some money and opened this place in L.A. called Spago. And his wife, who was from Brooklyn, had a friend, and his name was, it'll come to me, but he was a rock promoter. And he was the guy who was promoting Alice Cooper and some of these other guys. So she asked him for advice on, you know, what to do. And he kind of took him on as a client, almost, as a friend, you know, client slash whatever, buddy, and promoted Wolfgang to the point where Spago became the hottest restaurant in the United States. And then he took on all these other chefs as clients, so he branched out from rock and roll to food. And he had Jeremiah Tower from San Francisco and Mark Miller from Arizona and Stephen Piles from Texas. I think maybe even Larry Forgione, if I'm not mistaken, from New York. But there were five or six guys who were in the 80s who were pioneering all this kind of new wave cuisine, you know, American food and, you know, kind of championing local, this, that, and the other thing. And they kind of passed the words around in a circle for about 5 or 10 years. And it was all because of this one rock promoter, who I can't remember his name now. But anyway, that's how it all started. And Wolfgang, he had the first open kitchen. Spago had an open kitchen. He had all the guys, the cooks, in baseball hats with the word Spago on it rather than chef's hats and all the formality that went in the kitchens. And he brought the kitchen to the dining room, which was kind of brilliant. And, you know, he was going to do pizza. I mean, he was this, like, classically trained Austrian, you know, European chef who was a very talented guy. And he said, you know what, screw that. I want to do pizza. And he did smoked salmon pizza with caviar. And he had all these local Chino Ranch vegetables on his menu. And it was all California kind of centric. And it was the beginning of the American food revolution, like 1982, whatever it was, 82, 83. And I remember standing there on my couch. You know, I used to watch Great Chefs of San Francisco and all that. I'd be standing on my couch with the fist in the air because I came up through all the French restaurants, with the hot restaurants. And a lot of them were living on the fact that there was a language barrier. You know, so when it became apparent that Galantine de Valois Champignon was chicken with mushrooms, it was kind of all over for those guys, because now all that condescension and that French attitude was going up the kitchen vent, you know. And Wolfgang was making this more approachable and more fun. And, you know, going out to a high-end restaurant was now fun. It wasn't like going to temple or church where it was a solemn event where you had to just shut up and listen to the, you know, the maitre d' or whatever, you know. And, you know, you had all these people booking all these Hollywood glitterati. And as soon as that happens, I mean, the whole thing went, you know, magazine haywire nuts, you know. But he was the guy. And so it turns out that, you know, he branched out. He's got a million restaurants and he's got, you know, pots and pans and frozen pizzas and all this. He became this, you know, one-man juggernaut, you know, and he's the guy. You know, all the chefs, you know, and there's chefs making big money on Food Network. I mean, Guy Fieri, who is, you know, admittedly not a great chef. I mean, he had a place called Johnny Garlic's and Tex Wasabi's, you know, so he wasn't a serious chef. He was a cook, you know, a decent cook. Just signed an $80 million contract with Food Network.
Wow.
Yeah. And and Guy's very good at what he does. He's entertaining as hell. And, you know, I've met him. I've chatted with him for a bit. He's exactly who he is on TV. He's not faking it. He's a very fun guy. You know, he's quick-witted. He's just he's a happy guy. He's just great to be around. Good energy, you know. And, you know, so he opened up the door for that. I mean, you know, Guy Fieri would have never been able to sign a contract for $80 million without Wolfgang. You know, he was the guy. It was almost like when, you know, Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier, you know. Mm-hmm. Wolfgang broke the stay in the back, keep your mouth shut barrier, you know, for the chefs. And it became, you know, now you have these celebrity guys and, you know, all kinds of popularity. So it's completely different now. But anyway, let's take a little commercial break. We'll sell some advertisement and we'll come back and talk some more.
Amano Osteria and Wine Bar has been created by Adam Lovett and Tom Shawdell to bring the feel and flavors of a true Tuscan Osteria to the North Fork. Amano showcases local growers, farmers, cheese, and winemakers, marrying their ingredients with the taste traditions of the Tuscan countryside. The casual appeal, the flavors of Italy, and a moderate price structure appeal to all, ensuring year-round patronage. This North Fork eatery sends out snappy salads and seafood, pastas and antipasta, along with a respectable wine list. Amano features local vineyards and Italian varietals from the U.S. and Italian wines. The kitchen remains open until 11 and has established a later dining crowd, sparking a local nightlife dining scene. Amano is on the cutting edge of a new high-quality and affordable dining experience on the North Fork. Amano Osteria and Wine Bar, 13550 Main Road in Matatuck. Serving dinner daily, Amano is also open for lunch on Saturday and Sunday. For reservations and further information, call them at 631-298-4800 or visit them on the web at amanorestaurant.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Playing with Fire on 1100 WHLI AM and 104.7 WHLI FM. Long Island's own food, wine, and lifestyle show with your host, Tom Shawdell, chef, author, and restaurateur.
So recently I was in a place in Rosalind called Felice. You ever been there?
No. Was it in the village? Or
yeah, it's in the village. It's in the old Friend of the Farmer location there on,
oh,
on
sure,
Old Northern
right
Boulevard.
On the lake.
Yeah. I used to have a restaurant across the street, so I know that area really well. And I heard that they opened. I went down there and... sure enough, went in there. It's my second time there. Fun Italian restaurant, man. And what I like about it, it's not the usual suspects on the menu. And that really appeals to me because I love Italian food. And most Italian food that I find on Long Island is kind of Americanized. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's fine. But, you know, I prefer the real Italian stuff. And Felice kind of checks the boxes on that. You know, they have interesting pastas, a bunch of different interesting appetizers. It's all served in a, you know, kind of a pretty, almost like, you know, they have beams, you know, rough-hewn beams, kind of got that farmy look inside. Real pretty place if you get a chance to check it out. I would recommend it to everybody. I also recommend getting reservations because they've been pretty busy. Mm-hmm. You're in a honeymoon phase right now, you know, less than a year old. So, but really, right on the lake, they have an outside dining area, you know, which... I think it would be great until it gets muggy because, you know, that lake is Rosalind Pond there, the duck pond. You know, it's basically a mosquito, you know, nesting place. So be careful about that. Bring your spray. But, yeah, cool little restaurant, man. And it was a place across the street just opened up in my old location called the Brass Swan in the old Lemongrass location across the street.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I understand they do a real good job there, too, you know. So Roslyn, to me, was always such a fun... Do you remember the days we used to close it off on Thursday nights?
Yes.
Right? They used to block the streets off. It was like one big street fair, you know?
We even had that discussion with Epi the other couple weeks ago.
Yeah, an old high school buddy of mine, Brian Lilly, used to bounce there on, U.S. Blues, I think it was called.
U.S. Blues, that's where Madonna actually played in her day.
Oh, did she?
Yeah. Initial things. But you said you had a restaurant called Lemongrass.
I did.
And where did that name come from, and what type of menu did you have there?
Well, the name came from the herb, lemongrass, and which is an Asian herb, you know, Thai, really. And I had an Asian confusion restaurant. But I didn't call it Asian fusion. I called it an Asian-inspired contemporary American restaurant, for lack of a better term.
Well, that's where I was going. I was lemongrass... And obviously, I'm not as educated as you, but it makes me think Asian influence. And I did not know that you had a restaurant with that type of menu.
Yeah, I did for about 5 years or 6 years over there in Rosalind. And, you know, I know a lot about Asian food because I've been around Asian people, you know, a lot, you know, with the whole martial arts thing. And I studied it. I studied the flavors. And, you know, I know the food. But I'm not co-opting anybody's stuff. I'm not pretending that I'm a sushi guy, you know. And so that's why I called it an Asian-inspired American restaurant, contemporary American restaurant, because it was, you know, basically for me, it was Asian food filtered through an American sensibility. And, you know, it's proven to be a good idea, you know, regardless of what all the, you know, these political people say about, you know, if you're white, you can't, you know, you can't dress up on Halloween like a Mexican, or if you, you know, you're a white guy, you can't do Mexican food, or, you know, it's the whole thing is so stupid to me. But the bottom line is, you know, you take a guy like Tim Cushman, who's a chef up in Boston, in a place called Oh Ya, which is a sushi restaurant. And it's the most brilliant sushi restaurant I've ever been in. And I don't care what anybody says, and you can call me a supremacist or whatever, but the bottom line is he does it better than most of the Japanese guys I know. And if you don't believe me, you know, shoot the lock off your safety deposit box, go up there and have dinner, because it's incredible. It really is. And I don't use that word all that often. I've eaten all over the world, as most of my customers say, and I've never seen anything like it. He's just the guy, you know. But, you know, again, sometimes if you... You know, it's funny how people who are always talking about diversity, you know, get really weird about appropriating somebody else's thing, you know what I mean? And it's funny. It's the people who talk the most about diversity makes us stronger, man, you know, that kind of thing. And I'm not so sure that's true. I mean, diversity's fine, you know. Does it make you stronger? Nobody's explained how, you know. I mean, the Chinese aren't diverse. They're pretty strong to me, you know. Imagine how strong they'd be if you threw a few Swedes in there or whatever, you know. But the bottom line is, you know, diversity of thought when it comes to food, to me, is cool. You know, why limit it? Why couldn't, I mean, I've seen Japanese guys who've studied French cuisine who are really good at it, you know. And nobody's picking on them. What's the problem? You know, the problem is no problem. You know, we're just inventing a problem. So if you get, you know, a white guy who wants to take on, like, Rick Bayless in Chicago, he does incredible Mexican food. White guy, what's the problem? I don't get it, you know. Anyway, so I think that when I decided to do lemongrass, I wanted to interpret what I knew about Asian flavors into what I knew about contemporary American cuisine. And where's the harm in that? I wasn't an Asian fusion place. I'd like to make that distinction, because Asian fusion to me is a confluence of stuff, you know, like, you know, you have these, you know, like corned beef egg rolls, you know, that kind of thing. That's Asian fusion, or in my opinion, Asian confusion. You know, I think those things should be mutually exclusive. What I was trying to do was just do Asian flavors into my food, incorporate soy and miso and lemongrass and ginger and, you know, all the things that make Asian food taste the way it tastes into what I do as a contemporary American chef. That's it. I wasn't trying to pretend to be anybody else. I wasn't trying to put a fusion thing together or make a new cuisine or anything like that. I was just trying to use those flavors because I thought they were cool. End of story.
Interesting. And the name lemongrass for a restaurant is, there are a number of restaurants, and I don't know if they have copied you or it's a common...
It's a chainlet. I don't know who came first. It's a chicken and egg thing. I mean, you know, I didn't know that there was a lemongrass out there, because when you submit a name, I mean, you know, you have to clear it, you know what I mean, with the government. Like, if, you know, if I put a, you know, name out like Hendrix, you know, Hendrix Tavern, if I decided to name a place Hendrix Tavern, I'm sure the Paul brothers would have a problem with that, you know, and they should, of course, you know. You know, it's like me with the cool fish thing, you know, although that spawned a whole bunch of other, a school of fish, I should say, you know.
Well said.
But, you know, to me, it's like kind of, hey, man, you're ripping it off. I mean, all right, it's not a cool fish, but now you're opening up a fat fish or a cow fish or, a, you know, whatever fish. I mean, it's kind of my thing, you know, why you crowding me out here. But the bottom line at the end of the day is, you know, I could copyright the cool fish name. I couldn't copyright every other prefix fish, you know. So, you know, it's all fair, whatever.
I know that,
know.
I think on Long Island there's still a lemongrass cafe or something. And I know when I was down in West Palm, there's a restaurant, and I'm not sure if it's a chain, but I believe it is. But it's Asian influence. It's basically sushi and Asian prepared foods or whatever. They do it pretty good down there. And it's one of the few restaurants that I actually enjoy that is actually located in a mall environment.
Yeah.
But that be said, Long Island has taken that to the next step, because Roosevelt Field has an incredible array of restaurants now in their so-called food court, both internal and surrounding the property.
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic to me, because, you know, you have a couple of very high-profile chef/restaurateurs, like Tom Colicchio opened up Small Batch, and Michael White, who's actually not involved in the company anymore, they opened up Marini. And there's a couple others there. There's not Fresh Food, something.
There's so many Seasons or something.
Yeah, Seasons 52.
That's a chain, though, right?
Yeah. But anyway, excuse me. I think that without really knowing Long Island the way I know it, these guys come out of the city. And I think that was probably not the best choice for high-end restaurants because Roosevelt Field isn't a high-end place, you know, and I'm trying to walk a fine line here. I'm not trying to knock it, but it's not like Americana, you know, where you have a clientele.
It's definitely not, but it is upscale in a sense, maybe because of some of the stores, that the flagship stores. You got Nordstrom. Macy's has actually grown in over the years. It's got some interesting fashion departments.
Yeah, yeah.
You got Bloomingdale's. But it's interesting to me that in that exact locale and in the story that you're spinning, yet there's two of the major steakhouses, at least in Nassau County. You have Capital Grill, which again is a chain, and Ruth's Chris, which is a chain.
Mm-hmm.
And again, Ruth's Chris used to be the only location at Roosevelt Field. Now there's one in Melville, just down the road from us here at the studio. And then there's one out in Lake Grove, I believe. So they've increased their footprint here on Long Island. But again, I was actually just thinking the other night, I wanted to get somebody a gift card, thank them for a project they work with me on. And on the North Shore, like Old Westbury, Jericho area, near Roosevelt Field.
Yeah, yeah.
other than those two steak restaurants, there's nothing. I know if you go further east and north, you got Opus and Blackstone,
Rare 650.
You have the Jimmy Hayes.
Mm-hmm.
But it was interesting that that Anthony Scotto really hasn't hit that area. Although, you know, again,
yeah, Chateaubriand there.
You know, in Great Neck, you have
Peter Luger's.
Mm-hmm. You used to have Morton's. I don't know if that's still there.
I think it is, yeah.
And you have Bryant and Cooper, of course. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that makes sense on the North Shore. I think I've done cooking demos in both the Americana and Roosevelt Field. It's completely different clientele, completely different. And like I said, it's not one's better or worse than the other. I think one is a little more well-oiled. I think the North Shore has a little more disposable income in that area. Then, you know, and you have, you know, areas of wealth there, Garden City or whatever, and I'm sure there's pockets that, you know, people have some money.
The Manhasset area is interesting. You got Il Mulino.
You got
Lamani. Again, a little further east is Bryant and Cooper.
Sure, plus you have all those, and, you know, west in the mall there, you have, Cipollini and Toku, and, you know, they have a whole list of, you know, big-time restaurants that, you know, that are very expensive to be in, that are supported very well by the clientele there. I just think that, you know, when you start to go, and this is strictly from a restaurateur standpoint, it has nothing to do with how I feel about Long Island. It's just when you go south of Jericho, you know, Turnpike, and north of the Southern State, you know, things aren't, I don't think the higher-end restaurants do as well because I don't think there's as much disposable income. You know, you get South Shore on the water, you know, Merrick, there's pockets of big wealth down there, you know, all along the South Shore and all on the North Shore. The middle of the island tends to be a little less, you know. I mean, I grew up in Carl Place, so, I mean, you know, I know about that.
A thought came to me. I was speaking with somebody recently about Jimmy's in Port Washington and Louis. Was there a change of ownership in those restaurants or something?
I believe so, yeah. I think it was maybe about a year ago or whatever. Louis was sold. It might have been one of the Scottos. I don't remember now offhand, but it seems to ring a bell or whatever, you know. But, yeah, I mean, you know, listen, you know, restaurant business is really hard, and you know, you got to choose well. I mean, you got to choose your location well. I think that if Tom Colicchio had a little more experience on the island, I think he would have chose a different location. Now, I don't know what his deal is there. You know, they may have paid him to come in there. Who knows, you know. But I know I've been to Small Batch, you know, many times, and it's a very good restaurant. And I never see it totally full. Mm-hmm. Same thing with Marini. I mean, they're closed Monday and Tuesday, you know, which probably is a function of labor. But you know, I've been to Marini on a Thursday night at 7 o'clock, where there are 25 people in the dining room.
I love that in today's world, restaurants morph into the community. In the old days, there was no going out for dinner on Passover or Rosh Hashanah yeah, sure. or whatever. And, you know, over the years, many of the restaurants have decided to go that way for the holiday. Jolly Fisherman would have a Passover Seder.
Sure.
And it would be every table taken.
Oh, yeah.
I remember the Carlton, same thing. They would have a Passover meal and, you know, very well attended. But what I'm thinking of at the moment is Ivoroni Brothers, an Italian gourmet market.
Seder.
And one of their best entrees that they sell is called Brisket Judaica. And essentially,
that's funny.
They're providing takeout for Passover.
Yeah.
And I've been to my daughter when she hosts a Passover, and they get, where'd you get this brisket? It's delicious.
Ivoroni.
Oh, that's Ivoroni Brothers Brisket Judaica.
Great, yeah.
And if you can't go with the gefilte fish, you go with the sushi.
Yeah, exactly. You know. No, it is funny how you know, more and more people go out. I mean, you know, we're a generation that, you know, nobody cooks, you know, everybody's, I mean, look at how many takeout places there are. I mean, you know, nobody has breakfast at home anymore. You're at the bagel store, you're at the deli, you know, egg sandwich, whatever, you know. I was at, you know, my favorite bagel store out east, and, you know, I feel for them because, you know, it's gone up. And my grandkids, you know, when I'm out there, I always get them breakfast the next morning, you know. And, like, two egg sandwiches and two drinks and a cup of coffee, for me, it's like $35. It's like I used to go to dinner for that, you know. It's crazy.
That is funny. Again, when I when my son was a little younger, and you know, I could go to McDonald's and get the $2 hamburger,
yeah,
and
yeah.
I was fine.
Sure,
you know, but him, he would have to get some sort of meal.
Yeah,
and it could be $16 or whatever. I said $16 for McDonald's. I bet you it was just a little bit more. I could get a steak somewhere.
Yeah, $16, you could feed a family of 12 at White Castle. You know, 200. Pieces of beef and sliders or whatever they call them, things with the onions on them. Yeah, it's all changing, man. And you know, I'm convinced now, and the reason I'm kind of laying low a little bit is that I don't think that the restaurant model as I know it works anymore, you know. So things have to change. And I see it now. There's a lot more people going to prefix dinners and tasting menus and things like that. A lot of the high-end guys are starting to do tacos and burgers and pizza, so... You know, you can see that they've had it with the, I mean, I'll just speak for myself. Between the help, you know, the employee situation, the government, the lawyers, and the real estate people, there's nothing left. I mean, you know, every employee I have is a lawyer. They all know their rights. You know.
Well, it's funny.
It's
just
nuts.
I mean, even with negotiating real estate. Again, I mentioned that I was going to Pastrami King for dinner the other night, and I called up at the last minute to try to get a reservation. Nobody was picking up, so I happened to know the owner over there, Joe, and his family. They've been there forever, either in Merrick, or I guess it started in Forest Hills, I believe. But I know what his car is. I saw it was still there the night before Passover, and he had his whole staff there because they were preparing. Most of their business apparently is takeout for the holiday.
Right.
And, you know, it's a very creative name for the chef. Chef, how's it going?
Yeah.
And, you know, he tells me that there's 85 matzo balls in each of his pans that he's preparing. But, you know, in talking to Joe, it's just, it's crazy. It's just...
Yeah, there's no margins anymore. I mean, the food.
When I lost my trend of thought, but what the conversation that we got into was that the landlord sees him being successful, therefore you deserve a rate increase.
Yeah, he wants to be
rent
a partner.
Increase.
Yeah, no,
and he says, Stu, you know, I actually have to keep my eyes open for another location
yeah.
in case. And then I went through the discussion about. You know, does a restaurant need to move into another restaurant? I guess, is it that much more cost-effective?
It is. It's easier.
But I was shocked to think that he might have to relocate, maybe because of a greedy landlord or whatever. And it seems a shame because, I don't know, there's just a certain logistics that are there. Pastrami King's on the corner. Next to it is a Dunkin' Donuts. Somehow they share a parking lot and cooperatively, it says these spots are Dunkin' Donuts only. Please obey. And then I got a kick out of there's a sign for Pastrami King in the Dunkin' Donuts parking lot that they share, and it's blinking. And I said, I guess you got to get your sign fixed. He goes, no. He goes, do you know how much attention it gets because it's blinking?
Sure, of course, yeah. No, there's lots of ways to skin the cat, you know what I mean? You got to get that advertising out there.
So we got an interesting email from one of our P1 listeners, Bill O'Leary.
Bill, I saw him the other night, actually.
Did you really?
Yeah, I signed a book for him.
Cool. So he sent a series of emails, and he goes, from listening to the show, and we've been preparing for the holidays, got all my food shopping done before the show, including the ingredients for my matzo ball soup. Happy Passover and Happy Easter to you guys. And I wasn't quite sure, you know, which way he went.
Yeah.
So I go, which or both do you celebrate?
O'Leary? You didn't know which way?
No, but he was talking about matzo ball soup. And he goes, my wife's father died when she was young. When her grandparents would come to visit, we would celebrate all the Jewish holidays. So, again, there must be some Jewish blood in there.
Yeah, yeah.
And he goes, that's why I love all the Passover Easter food shows. He talks about Zorns. We talk about cats. Tom Wiggy for Jewish soul food. Mushroom barley. I think I know all the shows by heart.
Laugh
out loud. Pretty scary. Ben's Pastrami King. And he goes, you know, he got us a gift at one point, a Butterbell, which is a great vessel for Passover time because I used to have this butter cracking my matzo when I would try to prepare it. Now I have soft butter.
Soft butter, yeah.
So, at any
good
rate,
guy.
Thank you for listening. And, yeah, I'm probably going to be down in South Carolina when you are.
He's funny. You know, he came to Teddy's the other night. I was playing up there with Dorio, and he came and he says, you know, I said I would never do this, but he brought a book in. Would you sign it? And I said, yeah. And now I have this routine I go through. It's almost like Pavlovian, the response I get. You know, who do you want me to make it out to? Me. Okay. Spell the name. You know, and the only reason I say that is because I've had Tom, T-H-O-M, and then I put T-O-M, and then I waste the book, you know. So I've learned to ask, you know, Kathleen, is it C, a K, whatever. So we say, spell it. And he goes, B-I-L-L. And, of course, I felt stupid, you know. But, you know, who knows if he throws a K in front of it, you know, it's silent, you know, whatever. So anyway, Bill, thank you for all your interest in the show, and thanks for coming down and supporting Mike Dorio on Tuesday, and thank you for buying the book. And
so talking about the book, talking about you, and we're right near the end of the show. First of all, fire@whli.com, fire@whli.com. I need the audience to send in ideas, thoughts, recommendations of where we can have a Nassau County-based book signing for Tom Shordell. He keeps going out east. We need to support Nassau County. So let's hear from the listeners, and maybe we can actually get something scheduled in Nassau County.
Well, I'm getting closer. I'm doing one next Saturday at Twisted Cow Distillery in East Northport on Larkfield Road. So if anybody wants to come, it's $50. You get a copy of the book. You get a food demo and tasting with yours truly, a restaurant discussion, and a Twisted Cow cocktail. So it should be a good 3 hours. I'll be there from 2 to 5. Anybody wants to come down, Twisted Cow Distillery, they make great spirits. I've tasted some of their stuff. And you know me, I'm not a spirits guy, I'm a wine guy. So for me to say the spirits are cool is cool. So
that's so libaceous.
Yes, it is. It's libaceous as hell. Anyway, on that note, we're going to take off with Tom's Three Keys to Life, which is life is too short to drink bad wine. Treat every meal like it was your last. And keep chocolate in your life as important as sex and pizza. Have a happy Easter, joyous Passover season, and we will see you next week.
Amano Osteria and Wine Bar has been created by Adam Lovett and Tom Shordell to bring the feel and flavors of a true Tuscan Osteria to the North Fork. Amano showcases local growers, farmers, cheese, and winemakers, marrying their ingredients with the taste traditions of the Tuscan countryside. The casual appeal, the flavors of Italy, and a moderate price structure appeal to all, ensuring year-round patronage. This North Fork eatery sends out snappy salads and seafood, pastas and antipasta, along with a respectable wine list. Amano features local vineyards and Italian varietals from the U.S. and Italian wines. The kitchen remains open until 11 and has established a later dining crowd, sparking a local nightlife dining scene. Amano is on the cutting edge of a new high-quality and affordable dining experience on the North Fork. Amano Osteria and Wine Bar, 13550 Main Road in Matatuck. Serving dinner daily, Amano is also open for lunch on Saturday and Sunday. For reservations and further information, call them at 631-298-4800 or visit them on the web at amanorestaurant.com.